time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 12th of March, 2011. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Island, the stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them in Ocean View Road, Oniroa. On Saturday the 13th of March 2011, Jan Scott talked to Vern Whitehead from Waiheke Rugby. She spoke to community-led planning campaigner Marika Ransom and ex-librarian, author and thespian Rosalie Hennigan.
Now it's my pleasure to say good morning to Vern Whitehead, who is the president of the Waiheke Rugby Club. Welcome, Vern.
Good morning, Jan.
And now tell me, what's happening with rugby on the island, particularly with the World Cup? We're getting involved in that, aren't we?
Yes, it's a big year. There's thousands of visitors coming to New Zealand for the Cup, almost 100,000 overseas visitors. And, of course, a lot of them will be coming to Waiheke.
Yeah, that's right. And they'll be staying on the island and getting involved with the club. I gather that the club is going to be open during that time because there's a passport system. Can you explain that?
Yes, the overseas visitors are being given passports. When the World Cup was last held in France, it was felt that not enough people could meet easily, local people, local rugby people, etc. So this time round, they've made a special effort to get to make local people accessible, and the visitors are being encouraged to visit rugby clubs all over New Zealand, and of course they collect passports, stamps in their passport, and we'll be able to at the rugby club stamp their passports for them.
That sounds great. What a good idea. And the rugby club is going to, the club rooms are going to be open at specific hours, are they?
Yes, there's two things. One is looking after Waiheke people, providing a low-cost venue when they can gather with a few friends and a couple of cold ones and enjoy the rugby. There's 48 games and we'll be open for all of those.
And that doesn't matter what time they're being played?
No, it. They're in New Zealand, so the only thing is that one or two of the later games are on at 8:30 to 9:30 at night, and that's not too bad. The other strand is looking after the overseas visitors, and we envisage, this is an early stage, and we envisage that the club will be open for a couple of hours each day, probably in the latish afternoon, and the various tour operators on the island, the wine tour, the island tour, being asked to amend their tour slightly so they finish up with an hour or so at the rugby club.
That's a good idea. So the club's going to be open even when there aren't games on?
That's correct.
Right. And this will all be advertised, no doubt, so people will know,
yeah,
Golf News or Marketplace?
Yep. It's we've got a lot of planning to do. We're setting up a group outside the rugby club to manage, I guess, the whole World Cup experience for us, and we'll be looking for volunteers to man a welcome desk at Mātiatia, and just like the sculpture on the golf, we'll be looking to lots of local people to get involved. And
what a good idea. And it gets a lot of community spirit in there. And if people are wanting to get involved, who should they contact?
Oh, contact me in the first instance. But any of the rugby people on the island, they're pretty well known, and they can talk to us. And
so how do people contact you?
Oh, phone number is 3729109, and it's my email address is vern@autotalk.co.nz.
Excellent, that's great. Now, I gather you're also going to have the big screen at the club for these for the actual games.
Yeah, and I again, it's early stages, but we think we'll have to move for the quarterfinals on to another venue because we just won't be able to fit everybody in that wants to see the quarterfinals, the semi-finals, and the final.
Right, and of course the rugby club is headquartered at the Onitangi Sports Ground.
Yes.
And it's a great venue and a wonderful ground. We've had lots of compliments on it from people who've come across from the city, haven't we?
Yes, we have. It's quite picturesque. It's almost too beautiful for a rugby ground. But that's one of the...
I don't know, there's some pretty good-looking rugby guys.
Yeah, and in all of this we've got rugby as usual. We have a full complement of teams this season. There's three men's teams. Our C-Link Seniors, of course, which is the pride and joy of the club. And last year they won the Auckland Senior Championship. And they are starting their defence of it actually with an off-island game this weekend. They've been invited to play in the South Auckland Premier Clubs Tournament. So it's a real feather in their cap that they've invited to take part and compete with the best of clubs in Auckland.
So they haven't previously played in that tournament?
They did last year. That was the first year.
Mm. Okay. And they, of course, they did extremely well last year, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And they went all the way, as the saying goes. And there's largely the same core of the team is back this year. There's one or two new players. There's an English player that's arrived on the island. And we're looking forward to another wonderful season.
That's great. And what about the under-85s? Now, when we talk about under-85s, it's not under 85 years old. It's under 85 kg. So it gives gives guys the chance to play in a team that is more equal than if they were in the premiers. Is that right?
That's correct. It's age, it's weight restricted. It's the most popular grade in Auckland rugby. There are 30, almost 40 teams played last season. And we expect our boys did well. They got into the bowl competition and acquitted themselves really well. They're out training on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 6:30 at OSP. We'll be announcing a new coach for them this coming week. And they're all set to go. But one of the funny ones, I'll get growled at for describing it that way, the president's grade, the over 35-year-old blokes, and they start this Sunday with a barbecue and a game of touch and a few cold ones out at Onitangi Sports Park. And they're looking to play a couple of friendly games in the next week or two. There's against Ponsonby Club and the so-called Seniles from East Coast Bays. And they have a lot of fun, and they're always welcome, would always welcome new players. If you're over 35 and want to relive your glory days, well, just turn up at OSP on Sunday.
That sounds like fun. Do we have a women's team?
No, we don't. But the kids' teams, a lot of girls play in that grade. Of course, until they're over seven, there's no tackling. And they play what's called ripper rugby, and they wear little tags on their shirts, and they run around all over the paddock and rip these tags off and have a lot of fun. We've had the registration day for kids, but it was a shocker of a day, so we're having a second one next Saturday between 9 and 11. And any kids that want to play footy that haven't registered can turn up on the day with their parents, and they'll be looked after and made very welcome.
That's great. And that's at OSP, the Onitangi Sports Park. What time?
Between 9 and 11. And there's probably a bit of a barbie on for the kids. We're very proud of the children's rugby. We put a lot of effort into it, and there's a very caring, nurturing environment. And we have kids as young as 3 playing in the under sixes grade, and they just have a lot of fun with their brothers and sisters and so on. We cater for kids from that sort of age up to 12, and then the high school take over, and we have a close working relationship, partnership with the high school. And they did exceptionally well last year. We formed 2 teams at the high school, and we helped the school with management and outfitting and travel and so on. And the 4B, which is a weight-restricted side, they won their division in the Auckland Senior Schools competition, and that's almost unheard of for a new side. So we're expecting big things from them, and we also hope to have a 3rd team of the younger, less experienced boys that will be a feeder towards the 2 school teams.
That's brilliant. It's really good to know that there's such a lot of interest out there on in such a small population, really.
It is, and we spend a season something in the order of $34,000-$35,000 on travel for the kids and for the adults. We have a strong belief that nobody should be penalised because they live on Waiheke, and they should be able to participate in sport on an equal terms with their cousins in the city. We're fortunate we have 2 superb sponsors, SeaLink and Maiden Freight, and they both get right behind the club and assist us with funding that travel and just generally being superb in supporting people.
Yeah, because there are a lot of other expenses too, like the gear and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Doesn't come cheap.
No, and last year when we had to fund the setting up of the high school teams, you know, that involved an extra $10,000 odd for the club. But those are the things we love. They're the challenges, and you know, we're privileged to be able to provide sport for so many fine young people.
Mm, that's good. The other thing about the about watching the games done at the club rooms is the wonderful gourmet burgers that are on sale down there. And if you have not experienced a rugby club gourmet burger, you don't know what you're missing.
Yes, we're not a social club heavily, but we open on Friday nights, and Friday night footy is on, and we get a crowd of people along to watch the super rugby game of the day and on the big screen, and to have a couple of drinks at the end of the working week, and just enjoy themselves with friends, and of course have one of our famous gourmet burgers.
Absolutely. And I mean, you don't have to be a mad rugby fan to go along and enjoy the ambience of the place. I mean, when I first started going along, I hadn't seen a rugby game since I was about 9, and it was quite an eye-opener for me, and now you can hardly keep me away from the place.
Yeah, it's a nice scene, and to see dads with their kids there in the evening, and it's a safe environment, and doesn't go on all night, and you can have a good night out and for just a few dollars on drinks and whatever, and then go home.
That's right. So that is the Waiheke Rugby Club. Now, when is the first on-island game?
The draw isn't out yet, but the senior competition starts on the first weekend in April. So it's only a short while away. We've got a lot of work to do with training and so on. We hope the opening game will be on the island, but it'll be publicised in the Golf News and Marketplace, and we'd like to see as many people along as possible for the first game. The boys did so well last year, and both those that live on island and off island, they all regard themselves as very much Waiheke players, and they're going to give their best shot and see if they can knock off the Auckland clubs again this year.
And we wish them well in doing that. I'm talking to Vern Whitehead, who's the president of the Waiheke Rugby Club. And Vern, we wish you all the very best for this coming year. And of course, we hope people will get out there and not only support our local boys, but come along and enjoy the ambience during the World Cup without having to spend mega bucks to get to Eden Park or one of the other venues.
Yes, it's... it's very much something we can all participate in. We can't all be at the game, obviously. It's there's the costs and so on. So we intend to bring the games to the island and have a lot of fun doing so. And at the same time, as I said earlier, the chance to welcome overseas visitors, they're marvellous people. There are thousands coming from France and from the UK in particular, our cousins from Australia. So it's going to be great in having them on the island. And as a club, we just look forward to fitting in with the tour operators and accommodation providers and just providing another attraction that amplifies what they already offer.
Mm. And if there's anyone out there who would like to become a volunteer during the World Cup and greeting visitors on the island on behalf of the rugby club, contact Vern.
Indeed, and it'll be a pleasure.
And your contact details again?
Phone 9109 or email Vern at autotalk, or one word, autotalk.co.nz.
Thank you very much, Vern Whitehead. Thank you for coming in, and good luck for the season.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues, brought to you by Island, art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
And now it's my pleasure to say good morning to Marika Ransom. Good morning, Marika.
Good morning, Jan. Thank you for having me today.
It's great to see you here. And before we get on to this interesting initiative that you started up, the Flax Roots Planning Initiative, you're a planning consultant, I gather.
Yes, that's right. I've got I graduated in 1997 from the University of Auckland with a Master's in Planning Practice. So I've been working for about... nearly 15 years in the planning related area.
Mm. What got you interested in that field?
I suppose growing up on Waiheke, really, surrounded by seeing the sort of front end of planning happening, and a very active community engaged with what was going on. So it sort of rubs off on you, I suppose, as you're growing up.
Yes, indeed. And of course, Waiheke is a bit different to the rest of the world, isn't it?
I think, it's very lucky in that it has a very well-educated community and aware of what's going on in all sorts of fields. It's the arts, it's the sciences and business, very mm-hmm. innovative.
Yeah, and after you graduated, you went overseas?
Yes, I did. I travelled, did some very extensive adventure travelling in Africa and Alaska, and kayaking and cycle touring and sort of working along the way. But my first real job, I found myself drawn to the Isle of Wight, another island community. It's about four times the size of Waiheke. It's off the south coast of the UK, of England. And my first job was with Winchester City Council. So I commuted from the island, which was a two-hour commute, and I used to cycle, ferry, bus, train, and walk to get to work. That's five modes of transport.
And we think we're hard done by.
Yeah, but it was very good authority, local authority to work for. It was close to London. It had a nice Winchester city as a cathedral city. It was the capital of England at one time. And it has very nice, strong heritage buildings. But it also had a very rural, in Hampshire, rural settlements and villages. And again, a very active community. They were well-educated, they organised themselves well, and there was very good debate in the community about what the planning issues were and how to address the issues.
Right. So since you've been back on Waiheke, have you been doing consulting locally, or are you doing that in the city as well?
Well, as I'd had my first planning job was in the UK under a different planning regime. The UK also was going through major reforms to its planning system, which was a very interesting time to be in the UK in planning. I came back 5 years ago and realised that I probably should get my experience with the Resource Management Act, which is the New Zealand's framework for planning. And luckily, a job on the island came up for Auckland City Council with the Hauraki Gulf Islands Resource Consent Processing Team. So I've did 4 years there as a part-time planner because I also had my daughter and my son. So that was a really nice balance to work in that field on the island. And in end of November, end of 2009, when I saw the Auckland governance structures changing, I felt that I would prefer myself personally not to be in that process of change with an organisation. I would rather explore opportunities in the private sector. So I set up my own consultancy, Planning and Design Works Limited, and I assist applicants to obtain resource consent approval.
Right. Now, what prompted you to start up this Flax Roots Planning Initiative?
Well, the other part of setting up my own consultancy was to consider PhD opportunities. So I was looking at a PhD, and I was putting a proposal together around spatial planning and comparing the UK with New Zealand in terms of spatial planning. The Auckland governance legislation has introduced a spatial plan for Auckland, and I felt the experience I'd gained in the UK may be useful to do a PhD. So I've been accepted by the University of Auckland for that program. And I came to the point where, and that's where I also came across village planning, the village planning program, which initially started with Porirua City Council, where our new head of chief of planning for the Auckland Councils come from, Roger Blakely. Yes, I was just about to, you know, commit to a PhD, and I thought about my motivations and the commitment that would be needed to do a PhD, both in terms of cost and time and on family life and things. So I took a piece of advice which the head of Department of Planning said. She said, think very carefully about why you want to do a PhD. Some people can't complete and it becomes too much. And she said, so I said, well, I feel I've got something to contribute. She said, if you feel that strongly, just go ahead and start doing it, because the likelihood is that there's only going to be two people read your PhD. So that sort of encouraged me to think, well, yeah, what is actually stopping me from using my capacity on the island to start this type of initiative? So that's what I've done.
Right, and you've already had a meeting that you've addressed, haven't you? Or are you organising that at the moment?
Well, I started looking at what model the village planning program had started off in Porirua. They very much went through resident and ratepayers associations to help facilitate and build that from the grassroots, from the ground up. And they and I then looked at Ostend, where I live, and have realised that the Resident and Ratepayers Association dissolved in the year 2000, and we actually didn't have one. So I felt that was the first step. So we called together a couple of meetings. And we've had we've got 30 plus members already. We're having an AGM this Sunday at 2 p.m. to elect a committee. But that group had agreed to host this workshop that was run on last Monday on community-led planning initiatives, and I was able to get the speakers, really good speakers from Auckland, from the Tamaki Inclusive Engagement Strategy, who was Tess Liu. She was very inspiring, and also the Joel Umali from the Flax Roots Village Planning Program that's happening in North Shore. And that was also, we also had a speaker from the Campbell's Bay Community Association, Max Thompson, who spoke to us about how, from a very lay perspective, what the process involved. And at the end of that workshop, where there was about 50 people attended, we agreed to form a working party to consider the opportunities for community-led planning on Waiheke, and also to, in particular, to look at a community development scheme fund, which applications close on the 21st of March, which was very tight timeframes. We had a meeting yesterday of a small working party to look at that application, and it was agreed that yes, it might be tight timeframes, and it might be, you know, futile in thinking that it was possible, but it was agreed that actually just by looking at it, going through the process, there'll be benefits in that anyway.
So is this funding coming from Auckland City?
It's a Department of Internal Affairs program, and it's a 3-year project. The purpose of the community development scheme is, and I'll quote here from the website on the application form, which is on the Department of Internal Affairs website. The purpose is to support communities who've identified their needs to work together in new ways, to be innovative, to generate their own solutions to local issues, and to become more self-reliant and resilient. It is designed to support community-driven projects that will enable people to come together, build trust, and begin working towards achieving community outcomes.
That sounds a very great idea, and well worth aspiring to. The structure of the new Auckland City allows for this to happen, does it? That it is a real possibility.
Yes, I think what I've found very interesting is that it's not a structure that sits in parallel with the Auckland Council governance structure. It's very much complementary. So they don't compete against each other. They very much complement and support one another. There is a sort of a shift in planning paradigms. Okay, so best practice in terms of planning around the world has definitely seen this as a model that we need to work towards, the more co-governance model. What we found yesterday quite useful to refer to were principles for community development from the International Association of Community Development, which recognises there's 11 principles. These are local leadership. The community plays the leadership role in its own development. Government support. Government actively facilitates and supports community development through the provision of information, expertise, guidance and other resources as appropriate. It's a collaborative approach. Community development builds on cooperation, coordination and collaboration between government and communities. Balance. Community development builds on a balanced approach that addresses and integrates economic, social, environmental and cultural considerations. Respect for local values. Government strives to understand and respect community values. Equality and social inclusion. All community members, regardless of gender, age, ability, race, culture, language, sexual orientation or social and economic status, have equal opportunity to become engaged in the community development process and are able to access its social and economic benefits. Transparency and accountability. Government involvement in community development encourages transparency, accountability, participation and evidence-based decision-making. Partnerships and shared interests. Community development engages the necessary partners at the community and government levels. common vision. Community members and government define a common vision for the future. Focus on community assets. So it's community development is built on existing community capacity and assets, so it's not recreating another structure. And volunteerism. And community development values, respects, nurtures and encourages volunteerism.
Right. Now, I think on Waiheke we've become a little bit jaded with our hopes of ever getting cooperation with the city council as to what our hopes and aspirations are. So why should this be any different?
Well, I think that's actually going to be one of the things that is going to distinguish how we've already identified that need, because we can refer back to a number of forums in which that need has been expressed. The Royal Commission was the district plan review. Waiheke has continually sought to engage in a positive way with to form those positive relationships, and not always they've been. It's caused possible frustration with some members of our community. So I think there is an expressed sort of frustration that we've collectively felt. We'll be up against other community development scheme applications around the country, so we need to say why would we benefit any more than anywhere else.
Mm. I understand from community board members that they, or the local board members, that they have seen a very different change in attitude this time around with the new Auckland Council and the attitude of the office people, I suppose, to Waiheke has become more positive than it had in the past. So that's got to be a good sign.
Absolutely.
That this community initiative dialogue will happen.
Mm.
So where to from here?
Well, what's happening, yesterday we defined four broad outcomes which we'd like to achieve from this project, and they are greater knowledge and understanding of the needs of Waiheke, its people and communities, greater collaboration and partnership working between Māori, public agencies and private, voluntary and faith sectors to assist the delivery of projects and programs that affect Waiheke, its people and communities, greater understanding of local decision-making processes and opportunities for people to contribute in ways they feel valued and heard, and delivery of community-led initiatives, including the preparation of aspirational village area plans using best practice tools and resources.
Right.
So those are the four overriding outcomes that we've identified. The next stage is to specify the initiatives, activities and milestones under each of those headings.
So how are you going to do that? Are you going to have more public meetings?
Well, we had contributors to that working party yesterday have taken a section to draft. Those people included Sue Fitchett from the Forest and Bird Society, Daughter Ray of the Waste Resources Trust, Carol Whitesell of Waiheke Island Community Planning Group, and Anne Kilgour of the Matiatia and Onirua Residents and Ratepayers, myself, as well as Maggie Wakaira of the Waiheke Island Council of Social Services. So the Waiheke Island, WICOS as it's known, Waiheke Island Council of Social Services, has agreed to be the umbrella organisation that actually applies for this fund. So they would be the governing body that would administer this fund should we be successful. And what we're proposing, once we've drafted them, given the tight timeframes, which is actually we need to have this in the post next Friday, what we're drafting those, we've organised a short film of the workshop that was held on Monday, which is being done by Baraka, who is of the 100th Monkey Productions. She's put together a short film that will give people who weren't able to make the Monday meeting an opportunity to see that at Artworks Theatre this Tuesday at 6:30 till 8 p.m. So we're hoping to catch some of the commuters who weren't able to make that Monday meeting. We're showing that short film. We're also having the draft application up of people to comment and feedback and input into, and then we're going to quickly bring it all together for posting on Friday. So
that's great.
That's the plan of action.
Excellent. And then you know, if anybody wants to get involved with this, how do they go about it?
Well, they could give me a ring on my at home. My number is 372-3215. Or email Marijke, M-A-R-I-J-K-E, at planningworks.co.nz.
Right. And the Flax Roots Community Village planning model, that is relevant to what you're doing here, isn't it?
Yes, that is an initiative, and that's sort of why the Waiheke Island Council of Social Services can see very clearly why it's of benefit to how they work, because their sister city, their sister organisation, if you like, at North Shore, which is the North Shore Community and of Social Social Services, were successful with the same grant application, a community development scheme, for a 3-year project to fund and facilitate community-led planning.
Right.
Over there.
And there is a website for that, which is www.flaxroots.org.nz, if people are interested in having a look at that. Well, thank you, Marijke, for coming in, and we wish you all the very best for this, and hopefully we'll get back to you later in the year to talk about progress.
Thanks, Jan. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to say hi to Rosalie Hennahan.
Hello,
good morning,
Jan,
Rosalie.
And good morning, everyone, and another beautiful, beautiful morning here.
Isn't it stunning?
Oh, yes, just so beautiful. But I couldn't help but hear you talking. My heart goes out to the people of Japan who sent their team over to help us, and I think they might still be helping us, but they'll be all thinking of their homes. I mean, we know what a big earthquake is now, and the people of Japan have had several, of course, in the past, as we have done. But it's just so tragic, and it's just the start of their devastation. I mean, it's just awful. So, again, we're thinking of him, and we're very glad that we'll only get this marine thing. I was thinking of a swim, and I thought, no, not to go until much, much later, perhaps this evening, because you know, the currents are expected to be so bad, aren't they?
That's right. Yes. Yeah, I think that's one of their concerns.
Yes. Now, this evening at 7 o'clock, we're doing a play reading at Artworks, and it's to celebrate the work of Carl Nixon, who is our One Island, One Book that you were just talking about with Di from the library. And Di suggested, or someone suggested, that we do his plays. So we've got a play reading, and I am actually in, and Jan saw this at Rocky Bay, and what a delightful crowd, Rocky Bay, and what a wonderful hall.
Yes, well, it was a brilliant night. It was absolutely amazing. I thoroughly enjoyed both plays, both a lot of humour in them, but there's also the the serious undercurrent in both plays.
Yes,
and and I thought you were amazing with the multiple roles that you took in Crumpy.
Well, when I read the play and was asked to do the parts, and I thought, well, hey, I'm an old woman, how am I going to get on, you know, sort of doing all these young people and middle aged? And I thought, oh, well, you know, sort of Grant Lilly, who is, of course, absolutely wonderful, he does up multiple roles too. And he said, oh, it's the theatre, it's the imagination. So, you know, I thought, Jan, you've got a very good imagination. So
it worked extremely well. And we should explain that Crumpy is about Barry Crump.
Yes.
And I think most people out there would know who Barry Crump was.
Yes.
And it's based on his life. It's a brief story
of his
life.
The first half, I think, you know, how he was affected by the abusive relationship that his father had with his wife and his children, and how it rubbed off on the children, and how it affected Barry. And it's that, you know, you hear of this generational thing and you think, oh no, but yes, that's what happened. And of course, he was married several times, and naturally his wives, being another generation further on, fortunately got out of it, or saw the writing on the wall until he had undergone transformation. But we don't go into that in the play, we just do the effect of it. But the second play is also very, very good, because like you, I saw it for the first time the other night at Rocky Bay, and this time we're going to be putting it on at Artworks, and it's Two Fish in a Scoop. And just as our play stars Barry Crump Acker, Greg Deans, who's was wonderful as well in Foot Rot Flats, and he's equally wonderful, if not an absolute star, as Barry. So Two Fish in a Scoop features Forrest Denise and Tim Baum, who are two of our younger people on the island who are going to be sensational stars. They're so good. And it was a revelation to me to see Alistair Babbage and Linda Savage and the other people, Sean Carley, Hayley Halston, Lucinda Peterkin and Joe Whittaker, who all play terrific parts. Well, Joe does the sound and lighting. In the same way, Colin, our director, Colin Bearden, in our Crumpy play, does a wonderful job of the sound and lighting too.
Yeah, the sound effects were great, and the timing of those were brilliant.
Thanks to Colin.
From both his technical point of view and the actor's point of view, it was great.
Yes, we had quite a few rehearsals. So although it's a play reading, so we do carry our scripts, but I think you can get the gist of the feeling, you know, and it's a wonderful play, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, I didn't find the holding of the scripts at all a distraction, because your mind is taken off by there's so much happening, and so many things going on that I really didn't. It was just another prop.
Yes, yeah. yes, indeed. But I'm pleased you got the humour of it. I think that's one of the great things that Carl Nixon's got going for him as a playwright. I always remember doing a radio interview many years ago with James K. Baxter. And we were talking about something, and he said about humour, you must entertain the troops. So Carl Nixon definitely does that. There's so much humour in both these plays, but at the same time, the message is just so powerful.
Mm, absolutely.
So it's a pleasure to be in. And thank you for asking me. So come along tonight, Artworks. And if you've got very little money, that's all right. A koha or a gold coin. Of course, if you want to give lots, it'll be going towards the Women Without Violence, I believe, tonight. So
that's a great cause, and yes, fits in well with the...
And we've just had a wonderful concert, Women Without Violence, a week or so ago. It was just brilliant. I went along to it and thought, how good.
Yes. So how did you get involved with this particular play?
Well, I was asked to do it. I think the library thought Rosalie will be at a loose end. She won't have anything to do. We better give her something to do. And it's been wonderful because it's eased me into retirement.
So we might see you on the stage again sometime.
Well, it's a possibility because I really enjoyed this experience. But as I say, I had Greg Deans and Grant Lilly and Colin Bearden to work with, and just amazing. Just wonderful.
That's wonderful. That's great. Now, you mentioned earlier about interviewing James K. Baxter.
Yes. So years ago.
Tell us something about your radio career.
That started when I was about... Well, I wasn't even 21. I was a qualified teacher. I just finished my PA year. But during my PA year, I was asked to take part in the Country Girls radio quiz. And... it was quite funny, really, because country women were meant to know about cooking and things like that, and I knew absolutely nothing. I did know about farming, however, because I'd grown up on a farm, so I got very good mention on the farming side, and I was reasonable on the general knowledge because I'd always read a lot. So I got very high marks in those two, but of course my cooking was absolutely zero, and I missed out by about 2 points. But the judge said, look, if you want a career in radio, come and see me. And so I thought, well, that sounds interesting. So I did. So I did an audition and I got through it and I became one of the youngest women, announcers in New Zealand at the time. They more or less waited until I was 21 before they'd let me on air, and then I went into women's personality work. So I did Shopping Reporter and interviews, and then I became an afternoon personality. I don't know, you possibly don't remember, but they took the radios from 2 to 4, 4:30 every afternoon, Monday to Friday. And it was a very good community show because you interviewed all the people who were around you, and we also had interviews brought in from other parts, and we made documentaries. So it was a great background in radio. Now, at the time, I was working at 4ZB, which was Dunedin, And James Kay was the artist in residence, so of course he was a sitting duck and he had to come along and do it. But it was a delightful experience for me, and it gave me a whole new insight into the man. That was before his Jerusalem days, but he was heading towards that. So, you know, his deep spirituality came across, but also his humour. And that was something I hadn't expected. But having read some of his stories, I thought, yes, there is a lot of humour there underlying it.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yeah, he was a real character, wasn't he?
Yes.
So what did you do after you left the radio station?
I did the New Zealand housewife thing, and I had my daughter and brought her up and for many years, and she went on to varsity, and she's the one who's now in America, and which is why I go over there so often.
Right. And you got at that stage, you got involved in writing for Mills and Boone, is that right?
Indeed, yes.
So how did that happen?
Well, one of the people I'd interviewed was the doyen of Mills and Boone Writers in New Zealand, Essie Summers. And again, we're going back many years, and she was one of the last interviews I did, and I'd been saving her for something special because I loved her work, because it was so close to my own life. You know, it was something that New Zealand women could relate to be in the countryside, and her descriptions of the countryside were absolutely great. So you could probably get her books through the library. And so she had a totally delightful style of Mills and Boone. And the interesting thing is watching how Mills and Boone has changed according to how society has changed over the years. It was bought some years after that by Harlequin, who are the big Canadian romance publishers. And so that caused a few changes too. But I did enjoy writing for Mills and Boone. And before then, I had done quite a lot of writing for radio while I was at Palmerston North. And we used to have little programs like for Easter and things like that. So we'd talk about East making hot cross buns, or why Easter bonnets were such a big thing. And so I'd write a little thing with the help from the Palmerston North librarian, who had come up with a whole lot of books for me and this sort of thing. I'd ring him up and I'd say, oh, we need to do something on hot cross buns, so he'd find out the history. So he'd get it all ready, and then I'd string it together and rewrite it, and away I'd go. And the other thing about that was that radio was an excellent training for a writer, because you had to be very much to the minute. So that reminds me, I've probably gone over my several minutes, Jan, so...
No, not at all. Yes, your writing, when did you start writing? Did you start as a child?
Well, I had done a lot of writing, and I used to love writing essays when I was at school. And I remember my sister saying years later, no wonder you turned into a writer, Rosalie. I picked up one of your old essay books that I had kept, and she said, really, your imagination was way out there, you know. And so, you know, sort of maybe I always had an inkling of it. I did do well in English in my exams and so on. Hopeless in arithmetic, but, you know, that's all right. I can do enough to count my change.
Can't be good at everything.
No, that would be horrible, wouldn't it? But I always loved stage work, and I produced my first three-act play when I was at boarding school. So I did have a hint of stage, but then for so many years I haven't done any stage work except go along and thoroughly enjoy it. So now it's sort of turned around again, and to be on the stage again was absolutely a wonderful experience, thanks to, as I say, my very good colleagues.
Yes, exactly. So does this mean you might get involved with producing?
Oh, no. I'm nowhere near up to standard. I'm just looking for little bit parts or chorus work, possibly, just to get me back into it. The play reading was one out of the box.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. So what about writing a play?
The funny thing is, I had started on writing an opera because I loved a bass voice. And I might get time to do that now. I can't do the music, but I've got an idea for doing that based on a Maori incident. And I think it would work you know. Ooh. So that's working away at the back of my head. Yes. And then I've also got an idea for a play based on the life of another New Zealander too. But with that, it's going to take an awful lot of research, so I'll need an awful lot of time. So maybe.
You've got a lot of time now, haven't you?
Yes, well, once the play's over, I will have again. No excuses.
I think it often happens when you retire. You wonder how on earth you managed to find time to go to work.
Yes. Well, yeah. This last month has been like that. But yeah. Then, you know, I possibly wouldn't have been asked to do it because I wouldn't have been free. But, you know. Right.
Mm. Now, just getting back to work, how did you get become a librarian? What led you down that path?
Well, it was just that I came to the island and I knew no one. And, of course, me being me, I used to read. So, of course, one of the first people I met was Elizabeth Connell, the librarian, and she was absolutely charming, always so nice, and the staff at the library were always so good. And one day we'd got to the stage where I said, oh, I'm having a bit of a rough time with my book at the moment. And she said, well, would you like a few hours here? And it really started from that. So my few hours turned into 4 days a week and, yes, over the years, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, that's great. Yes, it's a great environment, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And very good team here with Fiona and Di, and the new lady seems very nice, Nio, who's taken my job. And, of course, Rhiannon is so knowledgeable about books too. So it's a wonderful, wonderful team at the Waiheke Library.
Mm. So you didn't have to have a formal education or formal...
I do have a university degree, and I didn't bother when I came here as a casual because I was just working as a library assistant. Right. I wasn't doing the admin stuff. And I never looked for that.
Because it is quite complex, isn't it, when you get into the cataloguing and all of that sort of
stuff. Yes, but yeah. The more you read, the more logical it becomes.
Yeah, I guess if you're finding a way around the library, if you're going there a lot, you would.
Yes.
I remember when the old library used to be down at Blackpool.
And oh, heavens.
School. That goes back a ways.
Yes.
And so I worked my way through all of the New Zealand writers, section. Actually, because it was so easy to find them.
Yes.
And then when it came to this lovely new library up here, I couldn't find a thing.
Oh, well, we've separated them out some time ago. So we've got the New Zealand writers in one category, in the fiction part. But, of course, in their subjects, they have to be in the Dewey, the New Zealand ones, you know, sort of. But it's fairly easy to pick them because we've put a little NZ on their tails, on the spine. So
that's very logical.
If you're looking for a New Zealand garden book, you can just look in the 635s. And, of course, you can always ask a librarian.
Of course you could. Yes, indeed. Indeed. So... Now, you've been overseas since you retired.
Yes.
Where did you go?
I went to Seattle, which is in Washington State. That's up the coast from California. So there's California and Oregon and then Washington and then Canada. Seattle is absolutely one of the most beautiful places. I don't know that I could readily live in the States, but Seattle is one of the places I would find very interesting. For one thing, it's Joanna lives on an island, Joanna being my daughter, with her husband, and he's a Kiwi as well. And he was married before, so they've got three boys, and now, of course, wee Patrick, my grandson, who's going to be 3 in April. So I wanted to have Christmas with them, even though I knew it was going to be a cold time of the year. So I did, and December was just such a beautiful month. It was blue skies and quite a sharp cold. But because it was blue and there wasn't so much wind at that stage, you could walk around and feel very happy. But then January came and it was warmer, but silver skies, so to my mind, very dull and grey, and I think I missed the sunshine. Mm. And I got sick, and it was a bit of a disaster. But, however, I did improve, and we went up to Leavenworth, which is this little Bavarian, or fake Bavarian, I should say, village up in the mountains. And I thought, well, that's something that those people were quite entrepreneurial about. The town was actually a delightful little mill town, and it was dying because the milling had stopped and the apple industry wasn't enough to carry it. But it was such a great area. The people didn't want to move. So somebody had built a Bavarian-style house and shop, and they used to get a lot of comments. So they thought, what about if we make the whole town Bavarian and have a beer fest? Well, now they have the biggest beer festival outside Munich.
Wow.
So they have cider festivals, they have ice festivals, and they have skiing festivals, and every month there's some festivals. So we were there just after Christmas, so we got the Christmas lights, which were absolutely stunning. And you can imagine all a little village up in the mountains, just absolutely beautiful. Snowed every night, beautiful blue skies during the day. So we had 3 days up there, and then we caught the bus back, and I had to go through a canyon, and I don't think I've ever been through a canyon before. It was scary. I was very glad we'd gone by bus. So my daughter and I had made the trip. Joanna didn't want to drive up there on her own, and having seen the roads, I can understand why. You would definitely need a heavy four-wheel drive vehicle, which they have got, but she wasn't feeling confident, and her husband really needed that for work. And so we went by public transport, and of course the trains were absolutely, I love trains, and the trains up there are just gorgeous. They're quite glamorous. They make planes look very fuddy-duddy. And I mean, the dining car still has silver service, and just wonderful. So I can recommend the trains on that trip. We went on one called the Empire Builder, which actually goes from Seattle to Chicago. And then, of course, there's another train which goes the other side. But Leavenworth is about 3 hours away northeast of Seattle. And it's a delightful town. So if you're looking for somewhere different, I can recommend Seattle.
That sounds great. So you only went to Seattle and then you came back, apart from going to Leavenworth.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Another time we'd been up to Canada and been to Victoria Island to see the Bouchard Gardens. But that's a whole different story. Absolutely stunning.
So are you planning another trip?
Well, I've got a lassie I call my other daughter. She's my daughter's very best friend, and they've known each other since they were knee-high to a grasshopper. And this lassie's mother wasn't able to keep her, but her nanny and granddad did. So she used to spend a lot of time at my house with my daughter, and she remains very fond of me, and I remain very fond of her. And she's been moaning because she's been over to see me about 5 times, if not more, and since she's been to Perth, and I haven't been to see her once. So I promised her this year I'd go. But airfares to Perth are horrendous.
It's an awful long way away, isn't it?
It is, I suppose.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's on the Indian Ocean, for goodness sakes. Yes. Yeah, I mean, we don't really think how big Australia is.
Yes, yes, but I would love to see the wildflowers over there, so that's a possibility. That's about September.
Ah, yes, if you get it to that, then you kill two birds with one stone, as it were. Mm. Yeah, I knew a chap, I worked with a chap who was a troubleshooter for the company, and he was based in Brisbane, and if he had to go to Perth, it was quicker for him to go via Singapore.
No, you don't. Right.
Because of
the curve of the
curve
earth.
Curve of the earth, yeah. So he'd sort of have a stop over in Singapore on the way, which sounds a bit weird, but there you go. That's just the way it is. But, I think it's quite a long flight from here to LA.
I've never been to Singapore.
Oh, there you go. Maybe you could
look at the flights for Singapore.
Yes, exactly. Well, yes. Rosalie, I mean, we wish you all the best for what you're doing in the future and for your retirement. But,
Thank you, Jen.
We must get back to what you're going to be doing tonight on the boards at Artworks Theatre.
I hope everyone will come along and have a great time.
Yes,
and if I make mistakes, please forgive me.
No, I don't think you make mistakes. Of course you don't. And what is happening at Artworks tonight is two plays by Carl Nixon, and the first one is called Crumpy, The Life and Times of Barry Crump, and that stars our wonderful Rosalie Hennehan. She plays 5 different characters in that. Greg Dean is Barry Crump, along with another one, and we've got Grant Lilly, who plays 5 characters, including a baby. He does a wonderful baby.
He does, doesn't he?
Yes.
He's brilliant.
And that's produced by, or directed by, Colin Bearden. And then after the interval, there is the second play, which is called Two Fish in a Scoop. And I guess in broad terms, it's the story of a Chinese immigrant and his family who own a fish and chip shop. And That has got that stars Forrest Knees and Tim Barmer's, the two young leads, and Alistair Babbage as Mr. Chan. He's an absolutely wonderful Chinese man. Linda Savage is his wife, and she makes a great...
I was taken aback by those two. They're just
fact,
so good.
It's really unfair to pick out anybody in particular because they're all so good.
Yes.
Sean Carley plays a couple of characters, and Hayley Hailstone is three different characters, and that's directed by Lucinda Peterkin, and Joe Whittaker's doing the sound and lighting, and both of those plays are on tonight at Artworks starting at 7 o'clock, and entry is by Koha, so you put in whatever you can afford.
And I do think 7 o'clock, I've got to reiterate that because people tend to think of going to the theatre with later. But this one, it's a great time because it's an early evening.
That's right. And it's not the play's not long.
It
finishes around, it would finish in a couple of hours. It's sort of just over a couple of hours with the break.
Yes.
So that's great too.
Yes. So you can go on to something afterwards if you wish.
Yes, indeed. And the proceeds... of tonight's going to the women living without violence, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, so do come along to Artworks tonight for a most entertaining evening. And thank you, Rosalie. We look forward to seeing you on the stage again sometime.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Okay. I've been talking to Rosalie Hennehan, and please do get along to that those plays at Artworks tonight. They're well worth going to see. There's a lot of good talent.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.